Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall, did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's Morning Lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you into the 9 o'clock hour. All right, so we can get to Chris Sims and CJ Stroud in a second. But playing off our last segment where we were talking about the intrigue in the Turkey Leg Hut documentary that appears to be coming out, we'll see.
Yeah.
You have a story.
I brought up that my dad was once, he wasn't charged with arson because his restaurant burned to the ground. He had a, so as
a shame, man.
Classic story of my dad who is, splitting time between his dairy farm and a seafood restaurant that he had started called the, what was it called? It was something like the Fish Hut or something like that. I think it was the Fish Hut.
Where was it? What part of the country?
Upstate New York, okay. Farmington, New York.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So it was right off, it was just a little restaurant, and he would, he'd milk cows all day. Then he would, manage the Fish Hut, and then sometimes he'd have to make a midnight run down to a fish market in New York City to pick up fish. And I don't know
who else.
He might have maybe packets of heroin or something. I don't know. So this was all when I was very, very young,
yeah.
And I didn't know anything about it other than that. Other than that, it seemed like my dad was working 24 hours a day. And then all of a sudden, one day, the Fish Hut burned down. And this is where my dad was never a suspect or a person of interest because he was leasing the space. But he was leasing the space from a guy who was kind of known as a little bit of the rubbing the nose.
Might have been
mafia. Okay.
Make things go away. Yeah.
Right. Now, so this is a guy. This would be a guy that probably, when it came to arson, potentially might have actually known. God, I gotta be careful how I speak here. I think he's dead, but still, he might have known what he was doing. But nobody told me about it. My dad, I was an adult when my dad basically told me the guy that we were renting it from was, it's probably for the best. I wasn't all that comfortable being a tenant there.
Yeah.
And it burned down and it was, my dad got the insurance money for whatever his fryers and all that.
Yeah.
Stuff
all
was,
his but, stuff. Oh
yeah,
my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, your dad, man. And then he went on to produce a movie. He went on to produce a movie after that.
Oh, he did so many things. I could write a book about my dad.
That'd be a documentary right there, man. That would be a good one. Text message, bad arson jobs, which are a majority of them, are easy to prove. The ones that have a legitimate source and little motive are tough to prove. Yeah, motive's a big one, I would say.
So I gotta take up a smoking habit, I think, if I'm ever going to pull off this arson
job.
Plus, Our house, we put all kinds of, you got the spray foam in, which means that you've got all kind of anti-arson spray all over everything flame retardant stuff. I don't think, knock on wood, I don't think I could burn my house down if I tried. Yeah.
No. Yeah. No, I wouldn't.
But as it's been well documented, I smoke 3 packs a day. And Brandy has always tried to get on me about falling asleep while smoking. Happens all the time. Do you hear me?
That's
hey, Ben,
right.
Can you take a clip of that and send it to me?
Yeah.
Put it in a folder. Put it in a folder called Future Alibis for Seth.
That's funny. Yeah, a few people texted in that the whole arson part of the story was actually allegedly arson committed on a business partner establishment of the Turkey Leg Hut. Yeah, so there you go. All right, so the documentary will have all this when it comes out.
I feel like if you're in any, the problem is the motivation for arson is that you're in financial distress.
Yeah.
And that's a number one, the first thing they're going to look at.
Yeah, right.
Like, oh,
right. Right.
This arson happened 3 days after you missed your third.
Yeah. That's
payment.
That's the fingerprints on the gun equivalent.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's,
why,
yeah.
you bought 18 gas tanks the day that you got your foreclosure notice. That's
right.
Interesting.
Right, yeah. Right. It's crazy. All right, so Chris Sims, he's Pro Football Talk with Mike Florio. Does a lot. He's on NBC. Got his hands in a lot of things football-wise, and he's got a list of quarterbacks. He power ranks the quarterbacks in the NFL every year at about this time of year. We're very thankful for that because it generates a lot of content. He is very high. This is the highest I've seen anybody on C.J. Stroud heading into this coming season. I think there were a lot of people that were this high just quantitatively. He's got him seventh on his QB power rankings. I think C.J. lived in the top 6 to 10 quarterbacks last offseason, Seth, coming off that rookie year. You couldn't find a power ranking that didn't have C.J. Stroud in the top 10 after he was offensive rookie of the year. It's a little different this year, but Chris Sims is still in on C.J. Stroud. Here is Sims saying a lot of the negatives for the Texans on offense last year were not CJ's fault.
A lot of the film and the negative is not CJ Stroud. I go, no, it's the Houston Texans. He can't block them. He can't get open for them. He can't call another play where it's like, wait, we can't block, so now we're sending. Remember, we had this conversation during the season. Wait, we can't block anybody, so we're keeping everybody in the block, so now we only have two or three people going out and routes downfield. Oh, and that's right, Nico Collins is hurt, and Stephon Diggs is not playing. So who's getting open? Oh, hey, we got Tank Dell. Okay, yeah, but he's about to get hurt too, so then what are we going to do there? I mean, so that's where we all threw it on C.J. Stroud for the step back, and I'd go, it was anything but that.
I think the biggest thing that we didn't address earlier, Sean, is really just how bad they were at consistently running the football. Because everything that involves quarterbacks in the passing game, whether it's their fault, whether it's not their fault, it's impossible on a play-by-play basis to say who's to blame, or a lot of the times it is, because you don't know who's running the wrong routes, like who is responsible for this pass protection, et cetera, et cetera. And by and large, 100% Chris Sims is correct in that. And especially when it comes to having a young center being the one in charge of making the calls on both run and pass plays, there are a lot of times that there's nothing CJ could do about it. But especially when you can't consistently run the ball, but you're a team who wants to run the ball, he just ended up in more second and longs and third and longs than anybody else. I 100%, if you want to go all stat nerd and say, oh, establishing the run is a fallacy, et cetera. Yes, there's a lot of truth when you say that. Like establishing the run to set up the pass, it's overblown. But you do have to at least competently run the ball. If you can't competently run the ball, then teams, it's so much easier to defend.
Yeah.
The teams, the way linebackers would just sit back 7 yards off the line of scrimmage, waiting to see if it was a run or a pass, because they were not that concerned about the run, but they were deep in coverage already. Like all of that, like any play action, it just didn't have any effect on the defense at all. And you're putting CJ in these situations where it's second and 10 and third and 10 so frequently that it's hard for any quarterback to convert those. That's why Pat Mahomes this year, one of the reasons, despite his numbers not being gaudy, one of the reasons they were still effective in winning games is that they would get to second and five.
Yes.
They'd get to third and four.
Yep.
Converting third and four is so much easier than converting third and
five. That 12. Might be, as you lay that out, it's really good. As you lay that out, I'm thinking, okay, what are the things about Nick Caley's offense that as we get 5 or 6 weeks into the season, we're looking at it and going, okay, this thing's working. The biggest thing might be third and whatever. Like the Texans were third and the worst last year. You know, they were third and averaged like 7, 8, 9 yards. Like they were third and long all the time. Yeah. If they're consistently on third down in third and a much shorter distance, that tells me they're running the football. That tells me CJ is checking down when he needs to and taking the profit that you talked about earlier in the show. That might be the one metric that if they just get back to where CJ is in just manageable third down situations, then you're not worried about the offensive line getting on it. Yeah. You know, you can use the quick passing game to convert those. You don't have to take those deep drops and get hit under the chin as you're trying to hit Nico Collins 15 yards downfield because you're in third and 14. You know,
and this is where if you think about the ability to run and why you don't have to be an awesome running team to set up play action. You just have to be competent. That Tennessee game, that second one especially. If you think about some of the things the Texans would try to do with that Bobby Slowick offense, okay, they want to run the outside zone, and that sets up play action really well, et cetera, et cetera. Like, Laremy Tunsil was, when you're running to the left and Laremy Tunsil decides, oh, I'm just going to seal this defensive end off instead of really trying to physically overtake him.
Yeah.
And that would happen every single time. You would watch the Titans linebackers and they would just sit back. They were not worried about trying to get to the sideline in case the blocking was right. They would just sit back and wait for the cutback.
Yep.
And then they would, if it was play action, great, because we're just sitting back waiting. We're not running laterally down the line. All the things that you would do to set up the bootleg, all the things that you would do to set up a cutback, they couldn't do any of it. Yep. So just that very essential thing of running the ball competently,
yep,
they were left without recourse, and it put them in bad down and distance situations. I mean, I could go about the way the whole offensive operation was. Did almost at every turn, they weren't doing things the right way to set CJ Stroud up for success.
Here is Sim saying CJ wasn't perfect, but he has no issue with CJ Stroud's decision making.
Was he perfect? No. Did he have some down moments? Sure, he did. But I think a lot of those down moments were more about like, oh no, the team's not playing well. We're not doing well on offense. I'm going to try to force something or make something happen. Right, or I'm under pressure and I'm trying to make big throws down the football field regardless of what I'm under and who's hitting me and who's open and not open. So that's what you look at. But I watch him and I go, I have no problem with his decision making. His decision making's really good.
Yeah, I mean, point out, you know, if you're just looking at stats, he more than doubled the number of interceptions he threw in his rookie year. So it's an easy thing to take issue with. He had some bad interceptions. He had 5 interceptions his rookie year. I think he had 12 this year. And there were some bad ones, you know.
One of the biggest things was that is probably at least partly because of injuries, he wasn't as pinpoint accurate. He had more instances. It wasn't as bad as the eyeball test, like watching on the TV copy at times or watching from the sideline in real time. You'd see some of the throws that looked like awful throws, and then you watch from the end zone and you realize, okay, actually he did the best thing he could right there.
Yep.
But there were times where he threw some ducks that just were not typical of what you expect from CJ Stroud. And hopefully that was just because of whatever injuries he was dealing with.
Yeah.
I don't like the old saying of a quarterbacks are either accurate or are not accurate. That still has a lot of substance to it.
Mm-hmm.
Quarterbacks have done a better job of becoming accurate quarterbacks or improving their accuracy. But by and large, it's still almost like if you don't have it by the time you get to the NFL, you're hard pressed to get a lot more accurate with few exceptions. And if you have accuracy and you don't all of a sudden, usually it's because of injury.
The underthrow to Tank was sort of the red flag interception in the Detroit game where Tank's wide open in the end zone. It's 23-13. He hits that deep shot to Tank and you're up 17. Deep into the third quarter, and CJ just underthrew it, and Carlton Davis undercuts it and intercepts it, and the Lions come back and win the football game. Like that was a game losing play for the Texans.
And then he had one to Nico too that was just a real errant throw.
Yeah.
I think in the Ravens game, wasn't it?
I think so.
Out towards the sideline.
Yeah.
Those are the things that you just didn't expect to see from him. That one. I'm glad you brought that one up. The Tank. Because the other part of that, which is a classic thing that happens when quarterbacks are injured. You could see him kind of almost hesitate and consciously think about whether he should throw it or not.
Yeah.
Instead of just planting and going, it was almost like a methodical, like, oh, can I make this throw?
Well, and it was jarring because a year before that, he would have just let it rip. His rookie year, he was letting it rip on plays
like that Jacksonville game, that deep shot to Tank Dell in the Jacksonville game.
Right, in between three guys.
He didn't even know if he should. Yeah,
it was wild. Ben, let's skip down to Sims 5 here, the very end, where Chris Sims points out that, hey, just look at the way the Texans operated this offseason. They agree with Chris Sims that CJ wasn't the problem.
There's a reason they fired their offensive coordinator after going to the playoffs 2 years in a row. There's a reason they've totally said the hell with our offensive line after going to the playoffs 2 years in a row. They are telling you without telling you the problems were the team, were not CJ Stroud. It was our pass protection scheme and our offensive line. And that's what they had to fix. And CJ Stroud, the Texans, I will not be shocked if they're in the Super Bowl this year.
Okay. I mean, that's a lot of confidence in the offensive line by putting a Super Bowl out there for the Houston Texans.
The one big questionable thing that I still have, and you know what? I'm going to write this in my Google. Remind me to put this in my Google Doc of Casario questions the next time we talk to him. When you're running a system where the center is making the calls, and theoretically that should help out a young quarterback because you know, it takes a lot off of his plate. I really would have wished that they had a veteran center in there doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big difference between Juice Scruggs or Jarrett Patterson and, say, eighth-year Chris Myers.
Right.
If you're going to be in a system where, like, you can have a guy that can actually see a lot that younger players aren't going to, there was a little bit of a brain drain there in having both a rookie or a second-year center and a rookie quarterback.
Yeah.
That part, I don't know how you overcome that.
Yeah.
Because that's a really complex part of the game that takes a lot. Like, just go ahead and learn pass. Go ahead and watch a YouTube video about learning pass protection and tell me after 15 minutes if you got it all nailed down.
That's funny.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
Well, that's funny because, the CJ's rookie year, Jarrett Patterson was the center for a chunk of it, but then he got hurt, and it was Michael Dieter for the rest of the year. Maybe just having a guy, you know, he'd been in the league a few years. Maybe having a guy who just had that experience might have been why they were working better towards the end of his rookie year than in the second year.
And it's still a concern of mine going into this season is that, okay, CJ's going to be making the calls at the line of scrimmage.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yep.
And except there's a learning curve with that. And he did a lot of it at Ohio State, so it's not going to be as much of a drastic change for him as it is for the vast majority of quarterbacks, young quarterbacks, but it's a process. So there's going to be some hiccups along the way. That's the part that makes me nervous about, no matter how good Nick Caley is, no matter how well the offensive line can do as a group and perhaps rising above just what their names are on paper, that it's a lot for a young quarterback to handle. And you don't just go from freshman year to PhD in one training camp.
Yep.
So we'll watch and see on that.
No doubt. All right. Payne and Pendergast with you. All right. Let's circle back to the Astros. Good night last night for the Astros. Is there a storm brewing for the Astros in a good way? We'll explain coming up next.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall, did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's Morning Lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.
2-2 wins, and that will do it. Yiner will have to complete the strikeout with a toss down to first, and the Astros win it 13-3 as they pick up a win in the second game of this four-game series. Cam Smith with two home runs, Mauricio Dubon on base five times, Cooper Hummel, Christian Walker adding home runs. Blummer, that was a full offensive display with five home runs for the Astros.
Freaking batting practice is what that was. Todd Callis on the call, Space City Home Network last night. Astros back at it tonight, 9:05 local time here. First pitch, they are in Sacramento. Two more against the A's tonight and tomorrow night. Framber Valdez on the mound tonight for the Astros. The big story in this one was, to me, Seth, the two home runs from Cam Smith. You know, I think they traded for him in the Kyle Tucker trade. They traded for him with the expectation that he is going to be a big power source for this team moving forward. And he's been fine so far his rookie year. For a rookie who's played very little minor league baseball, he's been just fine. He hadn't hit a home run since April the 18th, and last night he hit two. We could be on the verge here. Dana Brown pointed this out on the broadcast over the weekend. Like, once Cam starts feeling it and starts hitting them, and he hit two last night, so whatever he was feeling after that first one, it stuck around for another one. That maybe we're on the verge of a Cam storm here.
Maybe yes, and just like as he is in a much accelerated program compared to Kyle Tucker's rookie year, and after Kyle Tucker's rookie year, remember we were all looking at each other wondering why exactly is he untouchable?
Yeah.
Kyle Tucker was also a guy that it took a while for his power to really show up. He was really good at hitting stuff to the warning track for a long time, and then he got his stroke. But Cam so far has, in the last 2 months, been playing as an above-average Major League Baseball player. He just hasn't had that power that you know he's capable of. And you might say, well, okay, it's the A's. How much do we want to read into this? As a team, yes, this is the A's. And, hey, tonight you got Framber going up against Severino.
Yep.
So you've got your stud on the mound, and you could get away with having a lesser offense if you have to.
Yep.
Tomorrow night, you've got Colton Gordon going up against Jacob Lopez of a 4.8 ERA or what have you. Like, yeah, you need to feast on pitchers like this.
Yes.
If you're going to sustain this winning that has been somehow gotten you to where you are, a half game out of second place in the AL.
Incredible.
Without having any kind of a credible offense. We know that the potential is there. Cam is a huge part of it. Christian Walker has been playing at least like an average hitter over the last couple months, and his glove is an asset. Isak Paredes has been revelational in a lot of ways.
Yep.
It's just if you get Yordan back and he plays anything like normal Yordan, that changes a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it does. I was real careful for a while to say, like, okay, but he's just one batter, and it's not like that solves the bottom of the lineup, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom of the lineup has done some good things as of late.
Yeah.
Yordan being a lefty in the lineup and having the guys on the bases,
yeah,
that Yordan can sweep home, and having the stress that it provides for the pitcher, like all of that, there's much more of a synergistic effect than just Yordan's production coming.
Well,
back.
I think the feeling too that there are, I know that there are guys who their statistics for the whole year are well below expectations. You just cited Christian Walker. I think Yainer Diaz fits that. There's some guys that we're still waiting on. I mean, I think even Altuve to a degree that, you know, he's hitting 270. You know, he's hit 11 home runs though, that kind of thing. But there are guys who I think there's obviously room for improvement with some guys. But I feel like with this lineup, Seth, there's not, like in past years, like Maldonado was an automatic out. Like Jake Myers felt like an automatic out at times. Chaz McCormick, when he was in the lineup last year, felt like an automatic out. And I do feel like top to bottom in the lineup right now, they're at least battling a little bit and having good at-bats. There's not a, even the, you know, the catcher position, again, Yiner hasn't hit to the level that I think he's capable of, but the combination of him and Caratini has been a nice, solid professional hitter. They don't have any killers right now in the lineup. Like, you know, Jeremy Pena's had a really, really good year. So he's the closest thing. Paredes has had a really good year, too. But at least I feel like when they get to it used to feel like when you get to the bottom of the order, like, all right, we just got to get these three guys out of the way and get back to the top. They're having decent at-bats down there from 6 through 9 right now.
Well, and then the other part, that's the overflow effect of Yiner, too, of Yordan, is they haven't had... Like, they've seen so few left-handed pitchers.
Yeah.
So it just, there's the advantage that some of the lesser batters that you have in seeing a lefty, that evaporates. So, like, the guys who would get a leg up a little bit, the righties who could see a lefty more often, like, they're not doing it. Yordan being back in the lineup could change that a little bit.
Yeah.
So teams have been able to protect their lesser left-handed pitchers to an extreme degree versus the Astros.
Yeah.
They see no need to throw a lefty out.
Yep,
there.
That's a good point. Yeah, just the left-handedness of Yordan Alvarez is a big deal, let alone whatever.
Even though, no, like, Yordan's been about the exact same versus lefties or righties in his career, but pitchers are, like, they're still going to throw more lefties out versus Yordan.
Yeah, for sure.
Than they have been as of late.
Yep. I just want to relive some of the magic of Cam Smith, man. Todd Callis, give me home run number one. Put it in my veins, man.
Cam hits a high fly ball deep to left field. Cam Smith may have just hit his first home run since April the 18th. Cam Smith, number four on the season, connects on a home run to make it 3-0 Astros.
Like that.
That's what we'd like to see. Elevate to celebrate for Cam Smith.
Didn't call him the Camdy man right there, Seth, that I heard. Blum.
He probably said he read my notes, I think. And it's a... I don't know. Blum's nicknames are funny. There's something about the Candyman. I don't know. It just creeps me out.
Got
a very ice cream truck vibe to it.
A little bit. Now that home run, you know, just if you're just listening to it, sounded like, okay, there's a little question as to whether this one gets out. This one seems like far less question.
He drills one high and deep. Forget about it. Back-to-back jacks for Cam Smith. And the Astros lead 4-0. Dana Brown said they come in bunches. 2-2 at bats.
That was a bomb. Cam flexing.
It's big, man. If they start getting a power stroke out of Cam Smith, he's been fine just getting hits in big moments. Yeah. He's had some big moments. He had the walk-off over the weekend. But if he starts swinging a power stroke, that's a big deal for this team.
What's the more reasonable thing to wish and hope for? A top 10 over the course from now until the end of the season, they're in the top 10 in runs scored, okay, or the starting pitching gets stabilized and kind of healthy, and they end up like the starting pitching reflects the bullpen and is dominant outside of just Framber and Hunter Brown.
Yeah, well, but lately they've been really good across the rotation. You know,
they've been good across the rotation, but it's also still a small sample, and it's going. Hey, we get so excited when somebody goes six innings.
No,
it's
I know.
A miracle on ice.
Yeah. So what do I think? What do I think they have a better chance of from now until the end of the year being top 10 in scoring runs in baseball or stabilizing the starting rotation? You know what, Seth? They're going to get Yordan back. I'm going to go run scored, top 10. They do not play a tough schedule the rest of the way. They had one of the hardest schedules for about the first 40 or 50 games of the year, and they have one of the easiest schedules here for the balance of the season. Over the last, what have they played, about 80 games? We're almost halfway through the season here. The second half of the season, the schedule really eases up. And I do think that Yiner is going to hit better and Christian Walker is going to hit better. I don't think these guys are going to finish the season with OPSs in the mid-600s. I refuse to believe that. I don't think this is like a Jose Abreu situation with Christian Walker where Jose Abreu just looked like he didn't belong in baseball anymore. Christian Walker has good at-bats. He's starting to hit a little bit, hitting for a little power as well. So I'm going to go the top 10 rest of the way starting today, right? June 18th.
Yeah.
We're going to track this starting June 18th. Now, the other choice is a little more nebulous. I need what do they need to be in the start? Do they need to be like top 10 ERA starting rotation, or what do they need?
I think they're already top 10 ERA.
Yeah, I think the rotation is pretty good.
So. I think getting up, I said to be equal to what the bullpen is, or at least close to what the bullpen is.
Gotcha.
The bullpen has just been dominant.
I'll go offense. I'll just go offense blind on that.
I know, but I'll tell you what, this is one of those things where I pulled the stat up before the segment, but if you want an illustration of like how erratic the starting pitching has been, these are the leaders in innings pitched on the Astros this year so far.
Okay.
Framber, no big surprise.
Yep.
Hunter. And then you get down to Ryan Gusto,
mm-hmm,
Ranel Blanco.
Yeah.
Hayden Wisniewski.
Yeah. Wow.
Colton Gordon.
Okay, so Hayden. Okay, yeah, so these are all guys.
Yes, Wisniewski. Yes, yes. Yeah, Wisniewski.
Oh,
two of those guys are no longer on the roster.
I wish you had me guess who was third. You know what I mean?
Like, let's see. Okay, so I've told you the top, what, five? Okay, it goes Framber, Hunter, Gusto, Blanco, Hayden Wisniewski has the fifth most innings. Who do you think is number six?
I would go Lance McCullers.
Colton Gordon.
Okay. Oh, I think you even just said that. Okay.
Yeah. Then Lance McCullers.
Yeah.
And then down to Brandon Walter. Brandon Walter's been a horse with his 17 2/3 innings.
Yeah. I mean, these are your starting pitchers, man. Oh, yeah.
That is just a revolving door of various guys, some of whom will not play again this year.
Yeah.
It's in the fact that they've been as good as they have been, at least with the starting pitching, it's incredible.
And I think that the either or that you gave me, the difference is that to even just maintain, let alone elevate what the starting rotation is doing, you're counting on a bunch of guys who have started. You can count on one hand how many games they've started. Conversely, the offense, you're waiting for guys who have been high-level major league performers to just start hitting the way they're supposed to hit. You know, it's different counting on short timers to keep being great, to me, is obviously a very much more dicey proposition than counting on poor performing longtime big leaguers to achieve to the level we're used to seeing them do over 162 games.
With that smattering of names that I just threw out there,
yeah,
the Astros, their overall ERA, overall, all pitchers, their sixth best ERA in the league right now.
Yeah.
Starting pitchers are the eighth best in the league.
That's what I'm saying.
With,
like, I don't think they're
those guys.
Yeah, do you have the bullpen number in front? Obviously, bullpen's better than sixth if the rotation is eighth.
Let me just scroll down forever. Here we go. So the relievers are, they are fifth best
fifth,
in the league.
Yeah,
right now.
Okay. So, yeah, like, I think the two are very close. It just feels weird because of all those names you just had. But the
right.
fact of the matter
no,
is...
No, it doesn't. It's not a surprise that they've been that good. The surprise is looking back on it and seeing just how ridiculous it is that it's been this complete host of guys that's still one of the best starting pitching staffs in the league.
And then they just...
That is still top eight, despite a bunch of guys who aren't... Many of whom aren't on the team anymore or who are injured for the year. It's astounding.
They just dropped...
It's amazing.
They just dropped Jason Alexander in there last night. Six innings, two earned runs. Here you go. Yeah, it's been cool, man. It's been really, really cool to watch. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Final segment coming up. We'll find out what the guys on... In the Loop have going on today, question of the day and so forth. I have a question. I just saw a video from Sham Sharania talking about a player, not KD, who could be moved, but this player could be moved for four or five first-round picks. Do first-round picks even matter in the NBA anymore, or are they just the equivalent of pocket change right now? Slush fund, petty cash. We'll get to that coming up next.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall, did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's Morning Lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.
I Payne and Pendergast with you. Okay, this might be one that puts me over the edge when it comes to all these trades in the NBA involving four and five first-round picks. Here was Sham Sharania on the Pat McAfee show saying that Anthony Davis, if Dallas put him out there on the marketplace, he might command a huge return.
Too rich, right? Like last year we saw Mikal Bridges go for, what was it, five first-round picks. And the Nets got Bojan Bogdanović. Bojan Bogdanović was not a player for the Nets this season. Like, he was a non-factor. So they got those five first-round picks. In this case, you give up Desmond Bane, you get four first-round picks and a swap. And at that point, you get two players that you feel like can help you now a little bit. But they're doing the deal because of the haul of the draft picks. You think about Luka Doncic, that Anthony Davis trade. If you put Anthony Davis on the open market right now, he's fetching you four or five first-round picks right now. So I think it's about, do you want to trade for the player or do you want to trade for the picks?
Okay. We're going to wind up with an NBA, Seth, where it's just going to be 15 teams that have a boatload of first-round picks and 15 teams that don't have any first-round picks for the next 4 years. Like, that's what these trades are turning into. You know, Desmond Bane goes for four first-round picks. I mean, if Anthony Davis can go for four first-round picks from the Mavericks, then the... you know, like that's wild to me. Just that they were panned for that trade. Like, Anthony Davis was in a trade for Luka Doncic that has been hailed as the worst trade in recent history in the NBA. Like, he was on the wrong end. He went to the team that is being widely criticized for making the worst deal in the history of the NBA, possibly, for Luka Doncic. And that player, the main asset in the worst deal ever, on the wrong side of the deal. Sham Sharania thinks, and he may be right, that you could just put out there on the market and some team's going to give up four first-round picks. Like, do first-round picks even matter anymore in the NBA?
Right. Yeah, I don't know, and it also depends. If you're the Rockets right now, they are there for where they are, where they feel really good about a lot of the young guys and their potential and their upside. Yeah. They've got too many. They literally have too many first-round picks.
Yeah.
Now, it'd be one thing if it was their own picks. But they've got the Suns picks. They've got picks that are going to be high picks that are valuable to other teams. But it's, you know, in football, you take a number one overall pick every single year if you could. You're never going to have enough of those. In the NBA, there's only so much room for development as some of these younger guys. They've already got a log jam of that, you know, disgruntled Cam Whitmores and what have you.
Yeah, like, that's
right. How do you really get these guys the time to play and develop?
Yeah.
So for them, giving away picks is no big deal. It's just that the Suns, and they have a brand new GM who apparently doesn't want to just tank for a couple seasons.
Yep.
He wants to remain competitive. So the picks aren't as valuable to him because he wants to stay competitive while they rebuild. If the Suns said, all right, nope, we're going to reset hard, we'll trade away Devin Booker, whatever, I think the Rockets would have a really good chance of getting Kevin Durant.
Yeah,
I think they would gladly give a bunch of those picks.
And just take the picks. And it's their own picks. There's an emotional attachment to them. Like, oh, it's not just we're getting 3-4 first-round picks. Those are our picks. We get them back. Yeah.
And the four-dimensional chess here becomes that, yes, and then those picks become even more valuable if the Suns actually are going to tank because they're going to be higher draft picks.
They're going to be higher picks.
Yep.
So it's just, man, when...
So then Rafael Stone says, well, I'd like to give you this first round pick, but it turns out I think you're actually really going to suck the next few years.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give up.
It's just...
This is likely to be a more valuable pick than it is right now.
Yeah, it's just weird. Like, you're right. And some of it's, you know, obviously the football-basketball comparison gets clunky, as you pointed out. Just they're bigger rosters in the NFL than they are in the NBA. But it is wild. Like, the Astros, the Rockets have the 10th pick in the NBA draft, and I'm like, all right, whatever. They're going to pick somebody. Guy's not going to play. It's just it's a strange dynamic, and I don't know if I'm buying that Anthony Davis, a team's going to trade 4 first-round picks for Anthony Davis. You know, that because most of the contenders have a lot of them have emptied their draft pick, other than OKC. If that's the case, OKC has first-round picks out the wazoo for the next 8 years. Like, maybe OKC, who can't possibly get all the guys on the floor that they would use these draft picks on, then maybe they would give up 4 first-round picks for Anthony Davis and throw him out there with Chet Holmgren and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and everybody else. Might be worth it for them. They've got way too many first-round picks. Who knows?
Yeah. The whole – because we get antsy in the offseason, and you want now. I want it now. I want this sudden infusion. I feel like Rockets fans are very much split. Obviously, with a trade for Kevin Durant, a big part of it is what are you giving up? And there's people that – you know, you have your favorite players. You love Jalen Green. You don't want to see Jalen Green go. I get that. But a lot of it is also split between the just different worldviews.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that, hey, I love this young core. I love these players. And I think that they can develop with just some moves on the margins. We brought up the Miami Heat before. Like, the various guys who were guys who should have retired 3 years prior that were just lethal outside shooters for the Heat and what they were able to do for that team.
Yep.
Like, that's the kind of move that I think makes a lot of sense for the Rockets if they don't get Kevin Durant. They can be a markedly better offense simply by having more shooters.
Getting another shooter out there.
It don't cost a whole lot.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. As far as the Durant trade scenario goes, or as far as that storyline right now, it sounds like it's very, very cool right now. Like, it's cooled off where Phoenix has offers from the Rockets. The Spurs, who seem to be more, if you read the reports and listen to Shams, like, the Spurs are almost, it feels like, out of it altogether. They want to build around this young core, and you got Miami. Minnesota seems super motivated, but Durant doesn't really want to go there, according to the rumor mill. So I do wonder. I think Rafael Stone's playing this really well, playing it cool. The Rockets are definitely, I would say, if I were the Suns, that if somebody's making a big offer to me, I am not pulling the trigger on anything before I talk to Rafael Stone one last time. Because they've got the most stuff to give up. They've got the most assets of any of these teams right now when it comes to young players, older players, draft picks, their draft picks, Phoenix's draft picks. The Rockets have those, including the 10th pick in the draft. So I think that's where Rafael Stone can lay out and just kind of let this thing play out a little bit here over the next few days and see what happens. Because I don't think – is it Brian Gregory, the name of the GM in Phoenix, Seth? Brian Gregory?
Been on the job since May 3rd,
I don't think he's pulling the trigger on a deal without making one final call to Rafael Stone to say, hey, look, here's what Miami's offering. Can you beat it? That kind of thing.
And I could totally see it being that he might – this is a drama that might – go on all the way until the trade deadline next year.
Oh, man, that'd be something.
I mean, it's not out of the cards that that's how it goes.
Windhorst said earlier, if we played the audio on the show, that Phoenix just may not get any good offers that they like, and they may just run it back with Kevin Durant. That'd be really interesting.
Poor Kevin Durant.
Oh, that's, yeah.
He's living in the foster home of extremely wealthy NBA players, yeah, just waiting for somebody to come and
with just two rings. Oh.
Look through the glass and, yeah, say, yes, I like that. I know. It's hard. I know most people don't want to adopt older kids, but I like that one. Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
It is of kids who get adopted out of foster homes when they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. I would guess that the percentage of ones who are actually really, really good athletes probably get drafted higher or get adopted more.
You think
the old,
they're more desirable?
The old blindside dynamic.
Yeah. Oh,
I need to help this child.
Yeah.
Oh, who also can then go on to my alma mater.
To adopt one of these children, and here's my power ranking of all the children that are in this foster home right now. Yeah. Here's my big board.
You run a little combine.
Got Mel Kiper with you. Yeah, with a stopwatch. Text message. Guys, where are you putting Yordan when he comes back with the way they're hitting now? I'm leaving Altuve in the 3 spot, and I'll drop Yordan in the 4 spot. That's fine. I'm cool with that. I don't.
He's not going, as long as it's not leadoff. That's the only thing.
Right. No. Yordan fits perfect. I think in the 4 spot there with Altuve. Altuve seems to be comfortable in the 3. I don't think you do anything to jerk with Pena and Paredes. Pena ain't going anywhere. Pena's batting leadoff for the rest of the season. Paredes is a perfect 2-hole guy because of how selective he is. And then Altuve seems comfortable in the 3. I think it's an easy decision when he comes back.
You know, it is funny. I kind of tease myself with that sometimes. It would be dumb to put Yordan at leadoff. But like, people didn't like it when Springer was at leadoff, partly because he was not a conventional leadoff hitter. But yeah, there is something about the psychological menace of having, right from the get-go,
right from the jump,
having like the scariest pitcher out there.
Yeah.
Like the way it hormonally affects pitchers has a trickle-down effect. Sometimes I like thinking
they
about it.
They tried him in the 2-hole for a little while.
Yeah. And I didn't like that either. I just, it's not, like you can only push the boundary too far.
Yeah.
Defying conventional baseball logic. Yeah.
This is where
I do like the thought of just for sheer psychological terror of putting Yordan out there number one.
I like to think I'm a progressive thinker, but I'm somebody who likes their closers to have a 99 mile an hour fastball.
Yeah.
I like my big power guys like Yordan to be batting fourth.
It's really like the only times you and I have ever gotten into knockdown, dragout, like almost fisticuffs is when arguing about Ryan Presley as a closer.
That's right.
And me trying to be all new age, like, listen, man, look, ignore the whip, ignore strikeouts, all that. He gets the job done.
JP Francis.
And you would bust a bottle on you'd bust a Yingling flight over the bar and just come at me.
Right. Busted, yeah. And then I'm holding the pointy end right up to your throat.
Remember the time? Yeah, I remember the time Cody Stutes had to tackle you to keep me from murdering
that
you.
That hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that hurt. Cody Stutes tackling me. So, yeah, man. And I think JP France and Hunter Brown, that was a similar dynamic where
I was basing that on other than I like his hipster glasses.
I was infatuated with strikeouts that day too. You pointed that out. Like, you're,
well, yeah, okay. You know what, Sean? All right, I'll concede. Okay, Hunter Brown has done a little bit better than JP France, but when JP France comes off of throwing off of flat ground or whatever he's doing right now, we'll see.
I like
we'll
JP
see.
France.
Okay,
it's all good.
The story is not over yet.
I put Seth in a corner, man. Don't
me
put
and
Seth,
JP France slugging it out back to back as you and Cody Stutes are coming after me.
I love that Stutes found his way into this story somehow.
I got Cody Stutes at HOUfootball.com.
Yeah.
Cody does a good job.
He does a great job, man. He does a great job. Really good summaries of stuff going on out at the Texans stuff. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Crosstalk, sponsored by D&M Auto Leasing. Get that in, baby. John Lopez is
Quick.
Here. Reggie Atatula is here. How we feeling,
like
fellas?
Like 2 runs in the second.
That's it, man. Yeah, that's it.
Oh,
yeah.
Wait. Yeah.
That's a Jake Myers broken bat line drive up the middle right there.
That was
by
quick.
Me. Yeah. How about Cam Smith?
How about Cam Smith?
Exciting last night. Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah. Huh?
What happened? Is something special?
2 home runs, Reggie.
Decent.
Yeah, 2 home runs.
Decent game. Decent game.
Hey, what was the thing I was going to give Lopez credit for earlier in the show? Oh, it was during the break. We can't talk about it on air. Sorry.
I'm sorry,
listeners. I shouldn't have done that. I'll text it. I'll tell you during your next break. Lopez.
Okay. Actually, you can take text during the show. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I got a little Seth Payne in me.
No. Hey, by the way, you got to stop that.
What?
I have not been. You still talk about me like it's 2019 when it comes to the text line.
No. I meant multitasking during the show.
No, that includes it. I've cured myself of that.
Okay.
He's been cured.
It's very, very, very rare that I like check the text line during.
Well, then maybe I'm the worst.
It's almost like on our show, it's been like the worm has turned.
The problem.
It's like you know the episode where.
I'm talking Sean off a ledge. I'm like, Sean, I don't think the texter actually was criticizing.
Yeah,
you
no, it's text, like that episode where Kramer turned into Jerry and Jerry turned into Kramer. You know.
I meant to mention that to you because I heard you sometime the other day saying like, oh, I'm like Seth on the text line. Or something. I'm like, hey man, it's been years, really.
Yeah.
It's been since I rarely check the text line during the show unless it's for like a conscious reason. Not that I want to prove somebody wrong.
Yeah, John's like Charlie Sheen with all that nose candy. Charlie Sheen doesn't. Is he off the drugs?
Or I believe so. Yes.
Drugs? Yeah. Yeah.
Is
yeah,
he
yeah.
always alive?
Oh yeah, he's alive. Yeah, he's very much alive. You wouldn't know what to look at his teeth, but yes, he's very much alive.
John, you know what we do now though is Sean will selectively kind of pick a text that he knows is going to set me off. So that's where that's what I want him to do.
Yeah.
But that way, but I don't have the big danger, listeners, is if a host gets so upset or angry and needs to prove somebody wrong on the text line that he starts waging a text war. During the radio show.
Yeah.
That's the worst possible. Yep. You're trying to win a war against one guy at the expense of tens of thousands of listeners.
of giving the listeners what they want.
So I have a hard and fast rule that like if I want to carry the conversation on afterwards, I wait until after the show's over.
Yeah.
And I do it usually pretty politely and
Oh, on the text page still.
I'll be like, all right, I need to have a discussion with this person and I'll do it afterwards.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Question of the day.
You saw Sophie Cunningham last night?
I did. She took matters into it. Finally, somebody sticks up for Caitlin Clark on the team. What the hell?
She took her to the ground.
She did. It was good. I like to see that. I find what's going on in the WNBA with the league as a whole going
riveting.
All goon on I keep calling her Christian Clark. Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is silly. But
it's
good.
Silly, but it's good for the league. But
it's
that's
question
neither here
of the
nor
day.
There.
Yeah.
Who's your all-time favorite sports or non-sports bodyguard?
Bodyguard, goon, if you will,
as in Sophie Cunningham, that goon.
Okay. Now I grew up a hockey fan in Hartford, Connecticut. So I have two.
Okay.
One is named Torrey Robertson. He was the goon for the Whalers back in the mid-80s. So much so that I named my dog Torrey. I liked him that much. I had a Springer Spaniel for a little while, named him Torrey.
Mm-hmm.
The one that's the other one who also played for the Whalers for a bit, but before that, he was Wayne Gretzky's bodyguard, Dave Semenko.
I do remember him.
They called him Dave Cementhead.
Yeah, I remember him.
Dave Semenko is. Yeah. So I like that. And then in the make-believe world of professional wrestling, I found Kevin Nash in the role of Diesel to be an awesome bodyguard for Shawn Michaels.
Yeah. I might be the only person around that just loved Bill Laimbeer. And the reason is he owned it. Like people would say, you're an a-hole and a goon.
Yeah.
And he's like, what's your point?
Yeah.
What's your point?
Bill Laimbeer went to Notre Dame. Bill Laimbeer, the other thing that got brought up and probably made him very hated as well, apparently his dad was like a multi-millionaire.
That's another reason I respect him.
He's almost like the million-dollar man, Ted DiBiase.
Mm-hmm.
Laimbeer, huh?
Yeah, I respected him. What's your point?
That's a great.
I just didn't like Bill Laimbeer.
That's the way he handled it.
Yeah, that's how he handled it. Yeah, Seth's got an inquisitive look on his face.
I'm trying to think of like if I had to give grudging respect to like a dirty offensive lineman, like old school. They can't get away with what they used to. I mean, there used to be guys that try to break your finger in the pile. I had a grudge against a guy named Matt O'Dwyer once, who's one of the dirtiest players in the league. And we would go up against them twice a year in the old AFC Central. Back when divisions actually meant something, six teams in the division. At one point it culminated in I drove him over a pile, tore his MCL, and as he was laying on the ground writhing in pain, I told him that I hoped he died. We laughed about it. A couple years later, we kind of ran into each other and we laughed about it. But I felt like we both realized, like, do we want to live like this? And it was never quite as, that was the peak
good.
Of it.
Yeah, that's good that you guys made up. See, I think there's a distinction
Well, he's probably not on a cycle of Diana Ball or something.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think settled down a little
right,
bit.
Right, right. It affected his mood. I think there's a distinction between a goon and just somebody who's dirty.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Well, but with offensive linemen, I think they look at themselves as like, I'm going to do whatever the job takes
to protect
my quarterback and my running back. Yeah.
For sure, for sure.
Non-sports, Tommy DeVito, Goodfellas. Joe Pesci.
Oh yeah. An enforcer for sure.
Sorry, I did a quick Google on Matt O'Dwyer, and the picture that came up, I was like, yeah, I believe it. Just off of like the way that he looks, I look
That's
at
the punchable face,
the face guard as well. Yeah. He basically the has a Hosky like
face.
It's man, I would not mess with that one.
Well, the reason I brought up the distinction of dirty versus goon, it wasn't because of Seth's story about Matt O'Dwyer. I started thinking about offensive linemen as Seth was talking. I'm like. Conrad Dobler.
Oh, that's it. But didn't like him.
But he was just dirty. Like he was just, and he owned it. Mm-hmm. He had Miller Lite commercials about it. Yeah. So you like it if they own their dirtiness? That adds bonus points for you, Lopez.
And Lambeer, I liked because his father, you'd alluded to, was a billionaire.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't need to do anything.
Right.
But
how was his dad a billionaire?
I forget. I think it was some sort of shipping or something.
I'm not sure.
Logistics. Yeah.
Yeah.
Logistics. Yeah. That makes it even better. Yeah.
Like he was an importer exporter.
Yeah. That's right. I believe his name was Art Vandeleur.
Speaking of which, that's one of the reasons I like Julia Louis-Dreyfus so much. Because she could have just been a princess. Her dad was a billionaire as well.
And so she went to the hard minds of
acting. No, but she worked. She's still working.
I like her because I got a thing. I kind of like her. Yeah.
Also as well.
Yeah. You got any goons, Reggie, in the...
Funny enough,
save it for 10:40.
I think I'll say it. But I mean, one thing I will say is I also like Bill Laimbeer as someone who was like not alive during that period because my mom's favorite team of all time was Bad Boy Pistons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which that should tell you a decent amount about my mother.
Laimbeer could play too. That's the other. Like he was one of the best rebounders in basketball, and he had a really nice set shot. Like Isaiah or Joe Dumars found him in the corner. He was knocking it down. I got it right here. Laimbeer was born in Boston, raised in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Clarendon Hills, to be exact, before his family moved to Palos Verdes Estates, California. Oh, this guy became more hateable. His father, William Laimbeer Sr., was an Owens, Illinois executive who rose as high as company president.
Yeah.
The younger Laimbeer once famously joked, I'm the only player in the NBA who makes less money than his father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of respect that.
Yeah. Laimbeer played a Sleestak on Land of the Lost. That's in his Wikipedia page. Remember the Sleestaks?
Yeah.
Big googly-eyed guys.
And to bring this all full circle.
Yeah.
Also coached in the WNBA for a good amount
of time. He did. He did.
I think he won a title, didn't he?
Yeah.
I don't think he did, actually, the Aces.
Yeah.
College career, coaching career. I'll go find it and tell you guys while you're getting your show kicked off here. All right. So goon time at 10:40 today on the show. All right. Yes. This will be good. This will be really good.
Yeah.
Rick Mahorn. Names are coming in right now. Yeah, I don't want to harsh your segment.
It's all right.
Yep. All right, we're done. We're out of time. Seth, antibodies to you, my friend.
Antibodies and a broken beer bottle up your jugular to you bastard.
Revenge is a
France
dish.
Will rise again, you piece of
best
crap.
Best served by Seth Payne, yes.
Yes.
All right, Crosstalk brought to you by D&M Auto Leasing. Mm-hmm. We are done for the day. In the Loop is not. They're just getting it started. You're listening to KILT AM, KILT FM HD2, Houston, an Odyssey sports station.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Service is not available in all areas.
We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall! Did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's Morning Lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.